E4E is brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. In an effort to increase the availability and accessibility of UD expertise to Delaware's P12 educators, leaders, and policy influencers, we have invited faculty members from the University of Delaware's 9 colleges to share their research. We hope you enjoy today's critical conversation and consider ways you might be able to leverage relevant research and UD expertise to advance policy and transform practice. Hello, my name is Dr. Anastasia Pernton. I'm the Associate Director of the Partnership for Public Education. I'll be the host for today's episode of the E4E podcast, which was produced by Sarah Daniels, a graduate student in the Biden School of Public Policy and Administration. Today, we are joined by Dr. Tia Barnes, an associate professor in Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. Tia teaches courses related to special education, guidance on behavior, and social-emotional learning to both undergraduate and graduate students. Her work focuses on the social-emotional well-being of minoritized populations, utilizing social-emotional learning, culturally responsive pedagogy, and special education in her research. Today, she will be discussing her research on SEL interventions in urban schools, offering evidence-based directions for further research and implications for policy and practice. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tia.
Thanks for having me, Anastasia.
So my first question, before we get into our conversation, just so that we have a little bit of background information for our listeners, I'm wondering, what are social-emotional learning interventions and how does SEL benefit students?
So social-emotional learning interventions are going to be interventions that teach the skills that are necessary to process and also manage emotions and also help in engaging in healthy social interactions in relationships with others. One of the things I also wanted to say about social-emotional learning interventions is that social-emotional learning, it can be a packaged intervention, but it can also be something that we just teach through our interactions with others. It tends to be how we learn before we started talking about this idea of social-emotional learning, how we learned how to interact with others, how to regulate our emotions was by, you know, viewing what others did in those circumstances and how it worked out for them. And that should be something that we're conscious of, regardless of whether we're using an intervention as part of our SEL teaching or not.
Tia, before we move on, I sometimes hear SEL and PBIS together. Can you help us understand the differences between the two?
Yes. So PBIS tends to be the framing of how we're going to support our students. If we're talking about it in terms of mental health and behavioral health, this is going to be the framing of supports that we use to support students, depending on if we consider them tier one, that they have tier one needs, which tend to be universal needs, more specialized needs at the tier two or tier three level. Social emotional learning falls within that, in that we tend to provide social emotional learning as a universal intervention. So something that we're teaching everyone. And so we can also provide more specific or more explicit, more intensive social emotional learning interventions as we move up through the tiers, but it's just one of the types of interventions that we can provide as part of our larger PBIS.
Thank you very much. I think that's helpful just to sort of think about the definitions and the way those terms are framed. My next question is, have you found that SEL interventions differ in their implementation within different school settings? Specifically, we're interested in talking a little bit about urban school settings.
So I did do a paper that focused on this a while back. And unfortunately, the research showed that there are very few interventions that were delivered in urban settings that really differentiated based on the population. So based on, in this case, an urban population of students. Ideally, we do want to see that differentiation because social emotional learning is a lot like academic learning in that we need to modify, refine our intervention in a way that's going to make it relevant and engaging for the population of students that we're working with. And so it's important that we take that into account as we're developing and implementing interventions to make sure that the population that we are working with, that we're considering what their needs are in our delivery of these interventions.
So Tia, why is it important to understand SEL interventions in various cultural contexts, including race, ethnicity, gender, class, religion, and immigration status?
Well, a couple of reasons. The first being that how we interact with others, how we express our emotions is going to be influenced by these cultural contexts, right? So the context that you mentioned. And if we're teaching students SEL, typically this is going to be based on what we would just consider our typical American culture, which tends to be white middle class backgrounds. And in doing so, we're ignoring all the other factors. We're ignoring the different environments that our students go home to, and we're actually doing a disservice to them in that we're teaching them social emotional learning strategies that may not translate well to, you know, their everyday lives. We also want to make sure that our students are able to recognize differences in how we can express our emotions and in ways that we interact with others, because we do have a culturally diverse world. And so by taking that culturally responsive lens, we're also preparing our students to be able to go out in the world and interact in various environments and with various individuals, and helping them create this toolbox that's going to support them wherever they are. So for example, in thinking about the student's specific culture, let's say we're teaching students about emotion regulation and ways that they can regulate their emotions, right? They may be able to do this in schools. Perhaps we teach them how to talk about their emotions, how to, if, for example, they're angry with their teacher, how to express that and talk to their teacher about the fact that they're angry. And this may be a great strategy in school settings and with teachers that are open to that. But we may have students that come from households where a child is supposed to be seen and not heard. And so this idea of talking about the fact that they're angry with their parent may be seen as disrespectful. So we want to make sure that we're providing them with other strategies. So again, that toolbox that they can then use in those environments. Perhaps they can't talk about the fact that they may be angry, but perhaps they can journal about it. Perhaps they can engage in some mindfulness. Perhaps it's something where they do something physical, like run or move or dance, just to get out that energy, as other options that can be supportive in that. In the same way for us as adults, right? So you may have a boss that you work with that is not necessarily open to having conversations about whether, you know, you are angry or annoyed with them, but we find other ways that we can still express and regulate and get that emotion out so that we can move ahead with our day. And so it's important that we're preparing children for that. So I also wanted to talk about the idea of including cultural relevance as part of our work in making sure that we as adults are promoting a sense of belonging, right? So if we are wanting to ensure that we're supporting all of our students, we do know that minoritized students often have less of a sense of belonging in the school environment. And so for us as educators, keeping that in mind will also help in determining where we're focusing on for our social and emotional learning instruction. And so that is also a way that incorporating culturally responsive practice or culturally responsive pedagogy plays a part in social emotional learning and guiding us as educators in what it is that we're focusing on and what we see as the needs of our students, so that we can not only teach them skills, but then also help them in feeling welcome and creating an inclusive environment. With that, though, one of the things that I think is key to all of this is just this idea of making sure that we are taking into account the environment that we're working in, the students that we're working in, and that we're creating social emotional learning instruction that is going to support that population of students.
So in thinking about the importance of modifying to support the needs of all students, how can treatment fidelity be measured when it comes to SEL interventions?
Well, in the case of packaged SEL interventions, so interventions like Second Step or case of some approaches, so the Fly 5 intervention that the Center for Responsive Classrooms has created, in those interventions, there may be built-in tools to measure implementation. So for example, as part of the suite of materials that are provided as part of the intervention, there may be observation sheet that can be used by an administrator or a peer teacher to check off whether or not a teacher is going through all of the various components of the lesson and, you know, whether or not they're hitting on those components. In addition to that, we also may have just checkoff lists that educators can use to make sure that they are on their own reflecting, did they go through the various steps of the lesson? So that may be another way that that is measured in terms of treatment fidelity. when we think about like daily impromptu interactions with students, so social emotional learning in that sense, this is a little bit trickier in that we don't necessarily have a sheet of specific things that we wanted someone to do in that interaction. So my suggestion for this is to, as an educator, to consider what the student needs are, what the classroom needs are, and then reflect on any missed opportunities that may have come up throughout the workday. So within that workday, can you think back on any opportunities that lent themselves to you talking about conflict resolution or talking about, you know, other specific skills, responsible decision-making skills, time management skills, et cetera, that you want to reflect on and remember for the next time, just to help in building up that muscle of, oh, when I see these situations come up, I can use this as an opportunity to provide a quick lesson on a social and emotional learning skill.
Tia, how can Delaware schools promote SEL in an equitable way with culturally responsiveness in mind?
Well, I want to start by saying that the Delaware Department of Ed is doing an amazing job in terms of providing state support to schools and districts. And I know of several districts that are also doing an amazing job in their implementation. So just to shout out one of those districts, Capital School District, we have a book chapter in a new book that's called Social and Emotional Learning in Action, Creating Systemic Change in Schools, where we describe the plan that the Capital School District used to promote equitable SEL at the district level. And so I'd suggest for all those district leaders that are listening and that are interested, this is definitely a chapter that you may want to take a look at. Now, specifically for schools and something we want to consider at the school level in terms of providing social emotional learning in an equitable way. The first is to ensure that when you're choosing an approach or a intervention, and I guess I should also explain the difference between those. An SEL approach is more of a school-wide framework that we want to use for social and emotional learning. So these are programs like responsive classrooms or RULER is another one of those programs where it's more about teaching educators how to set up the classroom environment, how to set up the school environment. And so that's one way that we may approach it or look at social emotional learning. We also have, again, the interventions, which already created lessons that an educator would use during a specific time to teach a specific skill. Either way, and there is no right or wrong with that. You may want to use both or one or the other, but making sure that that approach or intervention that you're choosing is what would work best for your school community. So ensuring that based on the population of students you have, that this intervention was either studied with that population of students or created with that population of students in mind. One of the great things that I'm seeing nowadays is that, you know, every day there's a new social and emotional learning intervention that's coming up. We have the CASEL select list. On that list, it also will provide information on where or on what population an intervention has been studied or used with. And so ensuring that you're choosing things that would be of best use for you. You also want to make sure that as you're thinking about this, you are thinking about your broader school community. So making sure you have buy-in from your educators, considering, again, I mentioned the student population, also considering time and resources. Do we have the time and the resources to devote to this? You also want to consider the adults as part of this. So where are your adults in their own social and emotional learning journey? Where are they in their well-being? What training needs do they have, both around social and emotional learning, but then also around culturally responsive practices? I did a qualitative study at one point with an independent school that was doing a fantastic job in terms of incorporating culturally responsive practices in their social and emotional learning. And the advice that they provided, and that I'm going to share here, is this idea of first, for them, it was first most important to make sure that their educators had the culturally responsive background. So first, providing that training and ensuring that that was something that teachers felt comfortable using, you know, with their academic instruction, et cetera, and then layering that social and emotional learning on top of that. That is a piece of advice that I would share for anyone that wants to try to ensure that that culturally responsive piece is a part of what they're providing in their social emotional learning. Also, considering ways that you can connect with communities and families, because that's a lot of where, you know, our cultural experiences come from. So if we are not sure of what's happening in the community or what's happening with our families, how are we able to really ensure that we're creating and using the right approach to SEL? And also making sure that we do this from the very beginning. So not necessarily we as a school choosing an intervention and then saying, hey, parents, hey, community, this is what we're using, but actually including their voice from the very beginning. With that, also making sure that we're including our student voices is going to be key. I would also say ensuring that you're considering all of the students in your SEL implementation, because SEL tends to be presented as a universal or tier one intervention. Some populations do tend to get ignored in our delivery of this. One of those being individuals with disabilities, particularly those with mental health needs, because they're receiving supports at the tier two or tier three level, we don't necessarily consider them as much for tier one. But, you know, as part of this, we want to ensure that they are receiving instruction from that tier one level as well. So considering ways that we can best support individuals who have disabilities in social emotional instruction. And then also other populations, for example, those who are English language learners, how can we best support those individuals as we are thinking about who's the best SEL programs that we want to include? I also want to suggest this idea of knowing that, keeping in mind that SEL changes that we've seen that include things like improved academic outcomes, improved student well-being, these are changes that are not going to occur quickly, right? So we would expect these changes over several years. And so keeping in mind that it's going to take time, that one of the other key things that we need to have in place as we're including social emotional learning is considering our school climate. We need to work on that in preparation for SEL. When you think about what we're really asking of students and teachers as part of SEL, we're really asking for them to be vulnerable. We want them to bring their emotions into the school setting. We want them to talk about how they're feeling and talk through with others, you know, any issues they may be having. And so we can't really expect that our social and emotional learning instruction is going to be effective if we don't feel safe emotionally in our school environment. And so that's also key. When we're considering minoritized student populations, these are populations who, when we look at the research, tend to not feel safe in our schools. And so we definitely have to make sure that we're considering what we can do in terms of climate to ensure that we have set up that environment to then allow for effective SEL instruction.
So with all of that being said, Tia, how can the effects of racism on student mental well-being be better understood and addressed in meaningful ways?
The first thought I have is education. So with this, when we want to consider the effects of racism, we need to learn more about that. So learning more about systemic racism, microaggressions, and what our individual students have gone through. So both what their larger groups have gone through, whatever their identities, but then also what they have gone through is going to be important. We also need to understand the barriers that students may face when it comes to mental well-being. This could be barriers from like access to mental health services. It could be even cultural barriers that they may have to things like getting support outside of their household around emotions or mental health. And so being aware of that is going to be necessary. Also, knowing the areas of strength and resilience that these students have. So not necessarily just the barriers, but with the detrimental effects of racism, these individuals are still, in some cases, thriving or are still surviving, are still moving through. And so there has to be some resilience there. So what can we learn from that? And how can we use that to further support these populations. I would also say taking time to build meaningful relationships with our students is going to be key, both with students and families. That will help us in understanding more about the strengths that our particular population of students has, and then also the barriers that they're facing. One of the things that came up in that chapter with Capital School District was this idea of providing supports beyond SEL, because SEL is social emotional learning, right? And we know that we have to have certain needs met before we can really be in a place to learn. And in Capital School District, like some of the things that they did were just amazing, like making sure that their students had what they needed in terms of food, in terms of medical care and support, making sure that students who were moving around the district or who were homeless, regardless of what school they went to, they were going to be accessing that curriculum at the same place, right? It wasn't like when I move from this school to this school, it's going to be different. So all of that are going to be like things to consider that may be playing a part as well. Also, this idea of being aware, being truly aware, I think would sum it up, of how racism can influence well-being. We're in a time now where we are seeing a crisis in terms of student mental health. Our students are struggling, our educators are struggling, and being aware of how that may differ or look different for different populations of students so that we can best support them. So in the recent couple of weeks, I've become aware of some statistics. I know that we don't want to necessarily talk about statistics, but I'm just going to mention this one because it really stood out to me. And I think it's something that educators need to hear and be aware of. For Black students in particular, ages 10 to 17, there has been an increase in suicide rates of 144%, 144% increase over the last 13 years or so. And so knowing that is going to be important in how we interact with our students and what we look out for in terms of supporting our student, and keeping in mind that all of our students need social emotional learning right now, and making sure that none of our students fall through the cracks with that.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. I think you've really helped to both share some of your really amazing work, but also some other pieces that I think our listeners can walk away with to extend the work that they're currently doing. Before we move on, I know you did mention your book chapter with Capital School District, which is super cool. That's amazing. Also, the tools and the crosswalk from DDOE. Are there any other resources you'd like to point out to our listeners?
DDOE also has a resource that I supported with. I, along with all the stakeholders that are part of the SEL collaborative for the state, that provides some social emotional learning instruction for adults. So it provides adults with that may not know as much about social emotional learning with some of those foundational skills. So I would definitely look into that as well as another resource. And I think I've mentioned CASEL a couple of times. So that's the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. And on that website, you can find a lot of resources, including resources on how to go about social emotional learning implementation at the school level. I could mention another resource. So I have a podcast. So I mentioned the podcast before we started the recording. I do have a podcast that is for educators and parents that talks about how you can support your own social and emotional well-being. What we found in the field is that we are asking adults to support children in their social and emotional well-being. And it's something that none of us, for the most part, have been taught. And so we've, you know, kind of seen the need to back up a little bit and start with the adults. And so that's another resource that you may be interested in. It's called the Scholarly Self-Care Podcast. I think it's on most podcast platforms. I know definitely on Apple, Google, and Spotify, maybe others as well. And you can also access it on my website.
All right. Well, we will have all of those things linked and listed in the podcast description. Tia, thank you so much again for joining us today. This has been a really impactful conversation, and we're really lucky to have had you as a guest.
Thank you. This was wonderful. I appreciated the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of E4E, brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. For more information about the work being done by the Partnership for Public Education, please visit our website at www.udel.edu/PPE.